All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate. We got a hell of a show for you today. At the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with Tim DeChristopher, who is the subject of a new documentary called Bitter 70. Okay, that's Bitter, B-I-D-D-E-R, Bitter 70. And Tim is just got catapulted into the consciousness of people all over the world. Tim went into an auction that was being held by the Bureau of Land Management up in Utah, and it was an auction that was designed to give away all kinds of parcels of land, pristine land in Utah, to these oil companies to savage for oil, okay? And Tim went in and he raised his paddle, he bought a whole bunch of these parcels of land, and then when it came time to pay, he said, oops, forgot my wallet. And then they came after him. And he paid a price for it. He ended up doing 21 months in jail, and Tim has got out just a couple months ago, and he's gonna be joining us today to talk about that whole experience. Before that, we're going to be talking with Carl Dix. And Carl recently wrote an article called We Are All Trayvon, and We Need to Take That Message to the Streets. What happens when we let the system work? That's the question he's going to dig into. All right? And what does happen really? All these people say let the system work. Carl's going to talk with us about that. Well, opening the show up, this is one of those subjects that that I am really passionate about, but it always just enrages me. When I need to get up and talk about this, when I need to have somebody come on and talk about this, it's just that it's a killer. It's a killer situation. It's a killer topic. And it's one that I just, you know, I will never, ever just let slide by. All right. Joining us in the first part of the show is Stephanie McMillan, who is the niece of a man named Terry Lafitte. And Terry was 50 years old. He was the father of three daughters. He was attacked and killed by Linwood sheriffs in his own backyard. And that was on May 18th. On Saturday, May 25th, there was a powerful and defiant nighttime march that took over half of Alameda Street, east of South Central LA. And Stephanie's going to talk with us about her uncle, his killing, and the continuing demand for justice. Stephanie, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Why don't we start off with a little bit? Why don't you tell us a little bit about who your uncle was, the person that you knew, the Uncle Terry you knew. Who was he?
He was a kind, loving man. He had a great personality. Everyone loved him. Everyone in the neighborhood knew him. He was warm-hearted. If you met him, he would make an impact on your life. He was very outspoken.
When you say he was very outspoken, what do you mean?
Basically, he would tell you how he felt about you, no matter how the words that he would explain it, but he was just blatantly, you know, outspoken. Mm-hmm. Like if there was anything that he didn't like about you, he would let you know.
Mm-hmm. All right, now why don't you tell our listeners what happened on the night of May 18th?
On the night of May 18th. Well, when it all happened, I was in my room, and I was nurturing my daughter because I had just had a newborn. So I was nurturing her, and I heard my brother's girlfriend, Antoinette. She ran in the living room, and she was screaming hysterically. And I couldn't make out the words she was saying, so then she repeated herself. She was like, "The police, they're in the back, and they're beating on your uncle." So I had set my daughter aside. And I left her in the room with my cousin, and I ran to our back door, and I witnessed two L.A. sheriff men beating my uncle. They beat him repeatedly to the ground. One of the officers, while he was on the ground, had him in a headlock, and the other officer was hitting him in the back with the flashlight. So I was just trying to see what was going on, and they really weren't saying anything. So as I was coming outside, I had greeted my mom and my brother. So I heard my mom asking, like, what did he do or whatever. So we were all just trying to see, you know, what was going on, because we were like, what was the issue, or why were they in the yard and stuff like that. They really didn't tell us anything. They were just beating on him. So my mom, she was screaming hysterically. She was trying to get them off of my uncle, because when they came, they weren't really following police tactics. It was basically like an attack. Like, you know, usually, you know, when police try to confront you, if you're doing anything wrong, they will tell you you have the right to remain silent, or, you know, anything like that. But they didn't do any of that. We just seen them just fighting, beating up my uncle. So my mom had my mom had told them that they already had him restrained, but he was already laying on his stomach, you know, with his head down and his hands behind his back. And the other officer was just still choking him out, and the other one that was behind him was still hitting him. So my mom told them to stop hitting on him because they already had him restrained in their custody or whatever. And I remember hearing one of the officers tell my mom to tell my uncle to stop moving, but he wasn't moving at all. So I heard my uncle say this. He said, Sandra, he said, I'm not resisting arrest, because one of the officers said for him to stop resisting arrest. He said, Sandra, he's like, I'm not resisting arrest. I can't breathe. So after that, my mom, she kept screaming hysterically or whatever to try to get the officers off of him. And one of the officers that had my uncle in the headlock, he reached up and he had kicked my mom, and he told her to shut. I don't know if I can say this on air, but he told her to shut the F up or whatever. He kicked her into the door. So my brother was trying to stand my uncle's bike up on the kickstand, and the same officer that had kicked my mom, he pulled out a firearm, and he told my brother to get the F on the ground. So me, just in shock, I tell my brother, I'm like, lay on the ground and put your hands in front of you, you know, because, you know, they have a gun, and, you know, if you do anything, I'm pretty sure, like, you're in the wrong, they'll shoot. But he laid on the ground, he complied with the orders, and then my mom was still standing right there. So then the officer, he had put the firearm on my mom, and he told her that he would blow her effing face off. So my mom was like, you're just going to have to do it. So me, you know, I'm kind of like, let's see, like, I don't like any problems or anything. So I initially told my mom to come in the house, which she did. She went in the house. So at that time, it was just the two officers, my uncle, my brother. He was on the ground. So I don't know what it was. It must have been a gut intuition. I ran back to another door because we have three main entrances to our house. So I ran to the back door to where I can get a better view on, you know, how my uncle was playing or if he was resisting arrest, you know, so I can tell him to stop. But he wasn't moving at all. So during that time, when I had ran to the back door, I had witnessed the officer, which the one that was hitting him in the back, I had witnessed him sitting on my uncle's back. I witnessed him pull out a firearm, and I witnessed him fire two shots out. At that time, I don't honestly believe that he saw me in the back door because it was so dark. It was so dark in the backyard. So as he pulled out the gun, I was just in shock. My first initial thing was, okay, maybe they tased him. But then I thought to myself, no, tasers don't make a loud sound. And then I seen the red flame coming from the firearm, which it sounded muffled. Sounded like a muffled pop because I guess it was close range. So at that time, I thought that they had only shot my uncle in the legs because how the officer was positioned on my uncle, you know, I thought it would have been leg shot. After that, I ran into the living room where I greeted other family members that weren't outside, and I told them, I told my mom because she was on the phone. I said, Mom, I said, they just shot Uncle Terry. So I had ran out hysterically. Or whatever, and I greeted other officers in the front yard to tell them to get aid to my uncle, which they pulled me to the ground and they handcuffed me. They put me in a police car, and I just saw them bringing out other members of the family, and I even saw them pull up. They had like a wagon, and they took all the kids. It was about, let's see, I have three kids myself, including my 3 week old at the time. She was 3 weeks. Her, my son, my daughter, my cousin's son, and my two little sisters. They took all the kids from the house. They took everybody from out of the house. They didn't ask us any questions at the home. They took us to the station. Once they had took us to the station, they had interviewed all the family members, which I later found out that my uncle, that they had killed my uncle. I heard it through the other side of the room, which I heard my mom screaming hysterically, which I really didn't believe it. But then later on, I found out that it was true. Yeah.
Let me remind listeners, you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stephanie McMillan, who is the niece of Terry Lafitte, who was killed by the L.A. County. It was sheriffs that killed him, right?
Yes, it was the LA County Sheriff's.
And was that from the Linwood station?
Yes, correct.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll talk about that in a minute. All right, you know, one of the things too I wanted the people to know is that the whole, you know, what they say started this is that your Uncle Terry was a little inebriated riding a bike, and he didn't have a taillight and a headlight. And as far as I know, and according to the guy that writes the Biking LA blog, he made the point that even if your brother did have too much to drink and he didn't have lights on his bicycle, these are not death penalty violations. They're usually tickets,
exactly.
Fix-it tickets. You know, what's that?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And like I said, if he was, so they say, intoxicated riding a bike, he wasn't in an automobile. He already arrived at our home. So why would you pursue, you know, why would you pursue a person that's already on their property? Like, you know?
Right. Now, Stephanie, they also say, now, see, there's the way that they do this stuff. They actually, they kill somebody and with the act of killing them physically, and then they kill their reputation and the reputation of all the family members and everybody else who's all the witnesses. Now, I want to ask you a couple questions. Your uncle, they said he pulled a gun. What do you say about that?
My uncle?
Your uncle, yeah.
No, there was no gun at all. The only guns that I saw when I arrived outside was from the officer that had my uncle in a headlock, and from the other officer, the one that had shot and killed my uncle. My uncle did not have a gun. I did not see a gun.
Mm-hmm. Now, the other thing that I wanted to ask is, you know, they also do this thing where you guys actually recorded some of this on cell phones. What happened to that? What happened to those recordings?
Well, basically, all of the phones from the people in the house were confiscated. They confiscated 5 phones. I guess they weren't sure of which cell phone had the footage, so they confiscated all 5 phones from all of us.
And you know, you've never gotten them back?
We never gotten them back. I had to get another phone because they are telling the media that they never took any phones, which they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Amazing, huh? One of the things they also did is they also raised, and again, I think this is very similar to the question of the, you know, well, he was drunk riding his bike and he had no lights. And as you say, you know, leaving aside the point that he was in his backyard doing nothing, in his driveway doing nothing, he was home.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
But then what they raise is they say, well, all this man and all of his family have gang connections, as if that then makes it okay.
No, we are not gang affiliate. I don't know where they got that from or whatever the case may be, but no, we're not from a gang. The only people that were outside was me, my mom, my brother's girlfriend, Antoinette, my brother, and my uncle.
Mm-hmm. See, this is the thing, though. This is the big thing. That's what I mean about killing a person twice. They take his life away, and then they take his life away and his reputation. You know, and everybody else who can actually pose some problems for him because people see what they actually did. You know, so the thing is even there, you know, look, nothing they can say. I don't care if somebody is like heading a gang. That doesn't deserve
a
death penalty.
Kill them.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. And that's what happened. And I find it very, very, it's very revealing because the Linwood sheriffs, for people that don't know, Linwood is sort of an unincorporated part of the Los Angeles County, and it's run by the Sheriff's Department. They're notorious for their brutality, and also they, in fact, are famous for having their own gang called the Linwood Vikings many years ago. Not that many years ago, but they terrorized the streets.
Yes. It seems like since the police have been around, it's been a lot of stuff that's been going on in the neighborhood, which has never been this many crimes, you know? It's ongoing things that happen, and every time you look up, you see the police.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stephanie McMillan. And Stephanie is the niece of Terry Lafitte, who was killed by the LA County Sheriffs on May 18th of this year. Now, you guys had a march, and I imagine it must have been very hard to recover from that, from what you're talking about.
Yes, we had a march starting at from our home to all the way to the Linwood Sheriff's Station.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but we had marched there and demanding for justice and answers in the names of the officers, which they didn't comply or give us anything.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand they also, they did everything they could to sort of isolate the march and sort of attack the march and turn you guys back. Can you tell people a little bit about what they were doing while you were marching?
They were driving up and down the street. They had the sirens on. They were blowing their horns sounding. They even had a helicopter. They had blocked off some of the street and told some of the marchers that they have to go around. They were flicking us off, telling us F us. They were laughing, recording us. We were trying to give them flyers of my uncle. They kept throwing the flyers out to the ground, driving very close to like all of the marchers, almost running one of the protesters over, just doing everything in their power to try to discourage us from making it to the Linwood Sheriff Station.
But you guys did make it to the station, and in fact, you surprised them and went into the station, didn't you?
Yes, we did.
Tell us about that.
When we had arrived, we had everyone greeted at the front entrance, and we went in. And when we were in, we were just asking questions and asking officers, "What if it was your family member? You know, we need some answers because we have a lot of questions. None of our questions have been answered." A lot of the officers that were at the front desk, they had ran. They actually, you know, they ran behind the door. They didn't come out.
Yeah.
They were just looking at us, flashing lights, you know, taking pictures on the camera phones and stuff like that.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Stephanie McMillan. And Stephanie is the niece of Terry Lafitte, who was killed by the L.A. County Sheriffs on May 18th of this year. Well, listen, tell me, I have just a couple more questions. You know, one is, you know, your mom, she described when she talked about your uncle, she said they treated him like an animal. They killed him like an animal. Can you talk about that?
Yes, I believe they killed him in cold blood. They were choked. One was choking him, and they were just constantly beating him. He wasn't resisting arrest. All he just told my mom was, he said, "Sandra, he said, I'm not resisting arrest. He said, I cannot breathe." And that's when my mom was telling him, "Can you guys please stop hitting on my brother? You guys already have him in your custody. He's not doing no wrong." She just kept screaming hysterically. Because my uncle, when he said he couldn't breathe, it was like, you know, someone applying pressure to your throat. And, you know, like you're trying to get the word out. He couldn't breathe at all. So it was basically, they just treated him like an animal. I mean, you wouldn't probably do an animal how they did him. You beat him first. You guys beat him. You were hitting him all over his body, all over his back, choking him. And then at the end, you killed him in cold blood. You shot him.
Now one final question. Maybe I'll have another one, but one final one so far. Why do you think this happened?
Honestly, I think it happened. I really honestly believe, deep down in my heart, is the racial issue. I mean, I don't know what the case was. They said, because everything they're saying, it doesn't make sense. If you guys say that you seen my uncle on the streets riding a bicycle without a light, you guys could have put him over on the street. Why did it escalate to our backyard? Like, you know, you guys could have just let him go in the house and go to sleep. If he was intoxicated, he could have slept it off. You guys pursued him. You guys were the aggressors. You guys attacked him from the back. And I just feel like it was a racial thing because you beat him up first. When I arrived at the back door, I never once heard them read my uncle any rights. You guys beat him, and you guys shot him. I believe it's racial. I don't know if they were fearful for themselves, but my uncle's not the type to have a physical altercation with the police. You know, he's very much afraid of the police. So he would never even, you know, he would never even put up a fight with them. And the other officer, the one that was sitting on his back, was almost the same size as my uncle. So there's no way that, you know, you can say that you felt for your life or he was an aggressor or there was an initial scuffle with my uncle or none of that. Because, like I said, when I arrived, I seen them beating him up. They beat him to the ground. And if you guys could only see how he was positioned on his stomach with his head down, he posed no threat to no one.
Mm-hmm. All right, Stephanie, go ahead, finish. Go ahead.
Hands behind his back and all. And you guys still, he complied with you guys and all that, and you guys still just shot him.
Mm-hmm. Stephanie, is there a way that people can reach you or find out more about this?
Yes. We have a web page on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
It's called Justice for Terry Lafitte. We will have posts and links on anything that's going to have to do with, you know, getting justice for my uncle. We also have a number, which would be my mom's cell phone number, and that number would be area code 323-608-4097, and her name is Sandra. We're not going to stop until we get justice.
All right, Stephanie.
We're not going to stop.
Great, great. And keep me informed about what's happening with it, and we'll have you back on again as things develop, okay?
Okay.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephanie. And my heart is with you and your family, okay?
Thank you.
All right. Take care now. All right. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Stephanie McMillan, who is the niece of Terry Laffite, a 50-year-old black man who was killed by the Linwood Vikings, I mean the Linwood Sheriffs, down in South Central L.A. And, you know, once again, how long are we going to tolerate this? How long is this going to be able to go on? Now, I want to read you something that comes from a message and call from the Revolutionary Communist Party, and it's the revolution we need, the leadership we have. And here it is. Let me just read this to you, and then you can chew on this, all right? It is up to us to wake up, to shake off the ways they put on us, the ways they have us thinking so they can keep us down and trapped in the same old rat race, to rise up as conscious emancipators of humanity. The days when this system can just keep on doing what it does to people here and all over the world, when people are not inspired and organized to stand up against these outrages and to build up the strength to put an end to this madness, those days must be gone, and they can be. If you're not outraged, if your blood isn't boiling, then we got to have a long conversation, all right? We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party about what the hell does it mean when you say, just let the system do its work. We'll be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That's Garland Jeffries with Color Line, all right? And I thought that was extremely appropriate for what we're talking about today. And joining us now is Carl Dix, a founding member of the Revolutionary Communist Party, a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and he's the author of a recent article that's up on revcom.us. It's a website. People should all be checking that one out all the time, all right? And that article is called We Are All Trayvon, and We Need to Take That Message to the Streets. What happens when we let the system work? Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Sure. Well, let's jump up on this right away, man. You know, exactly as you're saying, and I was just thinking about this whole thing of, you know, when you listen to, I don't know if you had a chance to hear any of Stephanie McMillan in the previous segment, but...
Yeah, I was listening.
Mm-hmm. Yet another completely outrageous and just so enraging that, you know, it's hard to recompose yourself on after hearing this. And, you know, then you start to think about this thing that happens all the time where people, you know, suddenly there becomes this idea that somehow, well, what we should do is we should, once everything gets going, then we should just let the system do its work. You let the courts do their job. Let the investigators do the job. This, you say that this whole idea of let the system work, you say it's wrong and dangerous. Why?
Yeah, it's both. I mean, and we can look at it just through the prism. It's coming out around the George Zimmerman case and people saying, well, okay, you did your protest, you got the case into court, now just sit back and let the court work. That's all you got to do now. Let it do its job. And see, it's wrong for this case because if people had let the court work, it already worked when it let Zimmerman go, when the cops saw him standing over Trayvon's body with the gun he had just used to kill him, and they let him go when the cops drug tested the victim's body but did not drug test the killer. the system was working the way it has always worked. And the only reason there's a trial in this case is because people didn't let the system work. And if we go back to letting it work, we will get what we have always gotten from this. But also, it is just wrong from a historical perspective, because we can look back at the history of brutal oppression, vicious exploitation that black people have suffered under here in America. And at every point, let's look at what the system has done in relation to that oppression. We could go all the way back to slavery, you know, when they finally got a case to the Supreme Court in the 1850s, the Dred Scott case, and the Supreme Court came down with a decision that said, and I'm not going to its ultimate logic, the Supreme Court decision said black people had no rights that white people were bound to respect. That was the system working. And if that wasn't enough for you, even after slavery was ended, through all of the struggle that so many people put into that, the abolitionist movement, the uprisings by the enslaved peoples, and then the Civil War, where thousands and thousands of people died fighting to end slavery, including many black people and many people who had been enslaved, even coming after that, after a brief period of Reconstruction, black people were put back under slavery under another name. People would be arrested for nothing, convicted, and then sentenced to work on a plantation, a mine, or a factory in conditions worse than slavery. Jim Crow laws were put in. Separate and unequal conditions for black people were enforced. Thousands of recorded lynchings. And often the black person who was, and that's thousands of recorded lynchings of black people, more than 3,500. Often the victim of the lynching was not even accused of doing anything wrong. But no members of the white mobs who lynched all of these black people were ever taken to court. That's the system working. That's how it's always worked. And we could trace that right up to today. It's no longer Jim Crow, a law that says you can't sit on the front of the bus, you can't go to the lunch counter, and all of that. But it is cops patrolling black and brown neighborhoods like occupying armies. And all of this is because while the system has been rocked by the struggle of the masses, and that's what's led to changes in the forms of oppression, the system has remained intact. And it's that system that we're dealing with today.
Now, Carl Dix, let me ask you this. You know, you mentioned in your article as well that depending on the system to work as the way to proceed with things actually could guarantee that justice is never gotten. And when I read that, I thought about, you know, a number of cases just right off the top of my head. You know, I mean, there's Sean Bell in New York. There's Latasha Harlins, the young black woman who was killed by the Korean grocer back in the 90s in L.A. And her murder was justified because and people depended on the system to work. And then there was Rodney King, where everybody thought this time the man was beaten to within an inch of his life, didn't die just because he didn't die. And there was video. And everybody thought this time, let the system work because there's no way they can walk away from this one. And what happened?
Yeah, I mean, and what happens is prosecutors forget how to prosecute. And the judges who preside over the railroading of black and Latino youth to prison every day all of a sudden find technicalities and reasons to give favor to the defense so that the brutalizers and the murderers of black and Latino people get off. I mean, we've seen that recently in New York. The cop who gunned down Romarley Graham in his own house while his grandmother and younger brother watched in horror, the judge threw out the case against the guy on a technicality of the prosecutor having made an incorrect statement to the grand jury that indicted the cop. These are things that they never find when it's the other way around. And it's a question of a system that works to exonerate the enforcers who enforce the brutality and the inequality that black and Latino people face, while also railroading oppressed nationality, black and brown youth into prison. as part of an overall slow genocide that people are up against. And people have to look at it like the only way you're going to have a chance at justice is through determined mass resistance, people saying we will refuse to accept this stuff silently. That's the only reason George Zimmerman is on trial today. If people had sat back to let the system work, it had already worked, it had let Zimmerman go, and frankly, it's working to let him go again, and you can look at that now. You can look at that in terms of the way I was listening to you talk about how they kill people twice, and one of the ways they do that is dragging their reputation through the mud. You see that happening in this case with, you know, photos and stories about Zimmerman, Trayvon's school disciplinary record, some of the photos being faked and not even real. You saw it in the way that they bullied Rachel Gentel on the witness stand, trying to connect the white supremacist stereotype of suspicious black youth who needed to be treated as a criminal. Well, then uppity black female in the courtroom becomes a stand-in for that in another way to denigrate Trayvon and justify murdering him by going after a witness who was just basically telling the truth, that Zimmerman trailed Trayvon, followed him, Trayvon tried to get away, couldn't, and ended up being gunned down by this vigilante wannabe cop.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about what happens when people depend on the system to work in order to get justice.
You know, it's really important. I felt the same way when you were talking about the young woman that they were just bullying in the courtroom. You know, even the things that, as they're saying these things, well, you know, there's all this stuff that's going on, and how come, you know, you didn't go to his funeral, and you told his family that there was some other reason, and actually why didn't you go, you know? And then there's these other things, and when you're reading, you're thinking it's something, you know, you felt like shaking whoever was asking questions, saying, what, you never said to your mother, I can't make it tonight, I really feel sick, and you were actually going to a party, something. I mean, what are we talking about here? They take the smallest things and try to paint people as sort of low-life scum. And then that does, in fact, reflect back on Trayvon. And I think that actually, you know, in the way that they push it. And I think, too, the question of, you know, this is the thing. Were you troubled by any of the rulings that the courtroom is making right now? Because I looked at that and I kept thinking, wow, this is just getting a little, you know, it's getting not a little, it's getting a lot odd. You can't say racial. You know, you can't, the experts aren't allowed in. There's all this stuff that seems to be, you know, pushing at this, and including, you know, in the jury selection, it seems all these things are very troubling to me in terms of when people talk about, again, just let the system work, because you can see things are being piled up in a certain direction.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing the system work, and it started beforehand with the, you know, dragging Trayvon's reputation through the mud. But then once the jury selection began, you see the impaneling of an almost completely white jury. You see it in people being, a black woman juror being disqualified because her priest had made a statement in support of, her pastor had made a statement in support of Trayvon. Nothing she had done, but something her pastor had done. You see it in the prosecution not being allowed to strike a jury, not even being able to use one of their peremptory challenges on a juror who they felt was biased. I mean, you get a sense of the court stacking it in the jury thing. Then no expert testimony. Then the prosecution can't talk about racial profiling. I mean, that's all this case is about. He sees a black youth. He decides he's suspicious. He's up to no good. He decides to follow him, to stalk him even. And then he guns him down, and it's clear it's because of his race, but that can't be brought in. But then the defense can paint Trayvon as the racist and the aggressor on the basis of no information and no facts, when all the facts do actually point to the racial stereotype that's at the heart of this. And then you see the talking heads on TV, most of whom can't seem to get to this point about this is a case that is about racial profiling. It's about putting a bullseye on the backs of black youth, creating a whole generation of suspects because of the color of their skin, and then acting on that stereotype. And what Zimmerman did is basically what police forces do all across the country and what the criminal injustice system does in targeting blacks and Latinos, and it leads to racially disparate mass incarceration. I mean, that's what is going on around this. And if we let the system work, all the likelihood points to what we're going to get is what they've already given us in this case, mm-hmm. letting the killer of Trayvon Martin walk.
And I should
got deterred by our resistance last year.
Mm-hmm. And I should let people know that one of our listeners just called in and wanted to be sure that we remind people that think back about Oscar Grant.
Oh, yeah.
Caught on video, caught on this, and I really recommend people see that movie, man. It's Fruitvale Station. It's coming out. It's a very powerful film. See it. But also think about this. It's very heavy. You know, the cop that shot Oscar Grant was convicted of involuntary manslaughter and did, 11 months in jail? This you know, you think about this, and now, you know, is off enjoying his life. I mean, this is the kind of thing that when you talk about the system, letting the system work, it's the system rolling along. It's the system chewing through people's lives and just barreling the people down into the ground. I think your article is extremely important, and people should definitely check this out at revcom.us, revcom.us. The article is "We Are All Trayvon, and We Need to Take That Message to the Streets, What Happens When We Let the System Work?" And it's by Carl